Welcome to Ink and Magic, a podcast where we read and discuss the writing craft, world building, and romance of paranormal and fantasy novels.
If you love books with bite, set in worlds of magic and mayhem, then you're in the right place. My name's Nikisha Shanae. I go by an S.
And I'm Leslie. I write as Elle Penelope. And welcome to the show.
Hey, Leslie.
Hey, Inez. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Today, we're going to talk about endings. We talked about beginnings not too long ago.
Right. And so, yeah, it's time to talk about endings, the thing aside from the middle that every story needs.
And it's fitting that we're not talking about middles yet, because I think people have the most issues with the middle of their story. We call it the saggy middle.
Oh, yeah. I definitely do. Everything falls apart in the middle. So when we get to the end, we feel like we have something to share, something, yes, you know, cogent to share with the people. So
true that.
So yeah, endings, I think about them a lot. And I actually write standalones in addition to series. So I know that Inez doesn't believe in standalones.
I don't understand them. Like, what do you do all there? They're standing by themselves. They need friends.
Yeah, but also sometimes you're tired and you just want to write one book and not a dozen books. And that's when really understanding, I mean, you have to end every book, even in a serial, even in a series. Something has to happen at the last page, even if it is just an enticement for you to go to the next page of the next book. But endings are important and they should be satisfying. So what is actually necessary for a satisfying ending? So I think there are a couple of elements that you can include to make sure that the reader doesn't get to the last page and want to throw the entire book across the room, yeet it into the void.
Leslie, wait, because you know, we keep saying that, like, don't throw a book across the room, because we've had that experience.
Oh, with, yeah. Yes. Now this is, I mean, I read on a Kindle and I'm not damaging my precious Kindle, but sometimes I am just so close to like being like, burn down the world. The end of that book was terrible.
Yeah.
And why? One of the things that often happens is there is not a satisfying resolution. Mm-hmm. So I think the main plot threads should come to a close, regardless of whether it is a standalone or a series. An actual serial with a big cliffhanger, we can make some comments about that, but something has to resolve, mm-hmm, because when you just chop it off in the middle, sometimes it's like, oh no, I don't trust you anymore as an author. I'm not going to read the next part of your serial. You know, so main plot threads, the big story question, and you know, in a novel, let's say, should come to some kind of a close, even if it, you know, winks open, even if it's not everything completely tied up with a bow, which maybe it shouldn't be with a bow. That resolution is important.
I'm pretty sure that you taught me the term story question. And when you said that, it clicked in my brain. Because, again, coming from TV, which is episodic and serialized, you have an ongoing story. But each week, there is a story question, mm-hmm, that you want to answer in a mystery. Whodunit?
Right.
In like procedural, same thing. Like, whodunit? How did they do it? There's a question that you want to get answered if it's an ongoing story. And then there's always that bigger season arc. And you want to answer that bigger season arc, which is probably why Lost did not work.
Right?
TV show. But you can lead, there's a number of storylines going on. There's the main storyline or the A storyline, and then there's subplots like B, C, D storylines. And I feel that you can leave some of those questions, mm-hmm, open and unanswered, but something has to get answered or it just doesn't feel good.
Yeah. And so the story question is basically the thing that when it's answered, you know that story is done. Mm-hmm. So the whodunit in a romance, will they get together or not? There's always some big story spine, a story question, or there should be. And if you're having trouble figuring out how to end your story, how to end your novel, ask, what is the story question? What is the thing that the reader has wanted to know since close to the beginning? What doors opened at the inciting incident that needs to be closed in some way by the time the story comes to an end? Also, yeah, the character arcs. Character arcs, in arc fashion, they should come to some kind of conclusion. So the main characters will grow and change in positive or negative character arcs. There's also the flat arc character, which doesn't really grow and change, but still changes the world around them. So most of us are familiar with positive character arcs. The majority of commercial fiction, at least in the West, deals with a positive character arc. But you also have your negative arcs where the character, you know, a villain origin story, maybe your Michael Corleone from The Godfather is a negative arc where they descend. And then the flat arc, which is like your Sherlock Holmes, your James Bond, often they're mystery characters, Jack Reacher, who might not shift and change or grow in any way, positively or negatively, but they have affected a change in the world around them. They've solved the crime. They've brought the criminals to justice, something like that. So that arc, you know, has still come to a close.
I completely agree with you. And I know we both love James Scott Bell's write your novel from the middle and the mirror moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a way that you can tell has your character arced. Because remember the transformation triangle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where you have your how your character starts at the beginning, then at the end, how they their transformation. And in the middle, it's like they can look backward and see where they came from. They could look forward and their personality, because a lot of times when we're thinking about that positive character arc, is like they've grown as a person. Mm-hmm. But if you're having a flat or negative arc, it could just be, where are they?
Mm.
Are they moving towards their goal, regardless of whether they have changed or grown or de-evolved? But are they getting closer to that? And I think that's a way that you can figure out, has my character actually arced? What is the change? Is the change internal or is it external?
Or both, yeah. Showing up at the middle, often we talk about the midpoint being a false high or a false low in that change arc. Are they getting closer or does it seem like they're further away from their goal? And that's another thing to check for at the middle, which makes middles so difficult, as we've already alluded to. Another thing that I think you need for a satisfying ending is some sort of emotional payoff. And, you know, fiction is about emotion. It's about eliciting emotions in the readers. And you do want them to feel something. Now, it can be rage, if that is a thing that you are into. You know, we have our happy endings. We have our bittersweet endings. Not everything obviously has to be happily ever after. And the idea of, if you're talking about things that are not romance, and the idea of tying your story off with a bow may not feel right. And I feel that as well. I like a little bit of a bittersweet tinge, especially with my fantasy, epic fantasy stories. The romance is going to end happily because it is a strong, positive romance. But other aspects of conflict could be a little bittersweet, and that can make for a more powerful emotional payoff, in the same way that pure joy and happiness can also be a really good emotional payoff. It just depends on the journey and your goals, your themes that you're dealing with as a writer.
Yeah, you know, I think you told me about this too, Leslie. Leslie's just the resource. Just whenever you have a question, just email Leslie. But the emotions of Sorosis.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking to earlier about having the hard copy books and having things online. So once upon a time, I still have my original emotional thesaurus by
Angela Ackerman and Becca Pugliese.
Okay. I had the original, which was all kinds of torn up. It was thin, but it was all kinds of torn up. But they moved everything online. So it's one stop for writers. I love it. But here's the thing about emotional payoffs. They have all of these psychological explanations and evaluations of how they move, how they change. So you can go in and look at things like this character lost a sibling when they were young, or they witnessed a murder, and you can see what types of emotions they might go through. I find it an invaluable tool. I like the online more because I can carry more with me as I travel than having the print version.
Yeah, the emotional wound thesaurus. Mm-hmm. So they have a bunch of different thesauruses, including just a list of positive emotions and negative emotions. But yes, the emotional wound thesaurus, also the character motivation thesaurus, are amazing. I'm always in those when I'm crafting my characters. It gives you a list, you know, this long list of potential wounds and then what those wounds might do to the character. And it can spark something in you, even if you don't choose one of the things that they have listed. It is an excellent resource, onestopforwriters.com. I highly recommend that too. It's a paid resource, but it's worth every penny.
Every penny.
I use it all the time.
Because they keep adding more to it.
They do. It's great. So aside from emotional payoffs, Now, there's different kinds of endings, and I know that Inez has a theory. For me, there's a definitive versus ambiguous. More literary novels are often more ambiguously ending, so they not tying everything up. For commercial fiction, often you're going to get more of a definitive answer because you want to know, did the bad guy get his comeuppance? Did the lovers, live happily ever after? Did the mother save her son? Like, all of these story questions for commercial genre fiction often require a definitive answer. But if your story is more literary and is more internally focused, you can get away with a far more ambiguous ending that, doesn't wrap everything up, but leaves you really thinking, really chewing on the work afterwards, which is what a lot of writers are looking for.
Whereas I think that so I do have a theory of different there's different types of endings. There's a summary ending where you just wrap everything up like a standalone. I don't understand how to do that. They talk about if you're writing and you're going to publish a book, for example, on Amazon, if you write the end, Amazon's little bots see that and they immediately will put you onto their little sales page to try and sell you a new book. Like, if you have anything after the end, nobody's gonna see it.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yeah,
Wow.
you can see when you're reading, like it tries to go to you should read this next, and you have to X out of it and get to get back to the book.
Huh.
But even before that, I still didn't like to write the end because there was another brother whose story needed to get told, or the side chick, well, not the side chick, excuse me, the side characters, they needed their story. So yeah, I don't write the end, but that would be like you a summary. We come to an end, everything is whatever it's gonna be.
I've never written the end either, but I do write standalones. It just feels like, maybe there could be a sequel.
See?
I don't know.
Exactly. I think that when you have a cliffhanger, I think a cliffhanger, and the reason that people will grumble about them, yeah, they make you money, but the reason that people will grumble when they grumble about it, I think it's because they didn't answer the story question. There was an emotional payoff that you did not give them. I think that's what the cheating aspect of it is. People come to the page, readers come to the page for an emotional payoff. And I think you can give them that. Give them some kind of a closure, and then do the cliffhanger, which I call an open door. If you give me closure and then a cliffhanger, that's an open door for me, because it's like you answer one story question, and you either answer or you ask a new story question. That's what I think is satisfying, because you give me all of the emotion on the arc. You come full circle, and then you go a little bit past that circle to start a new journey, and then I have to come back.
Yeah. And I think movies like Dune and Lord of the Rings, when they're split into parts, did it really well. You closed a door, you're not at the end, but you have enough of this story question for this piece of the journey has been answered.
Yes.
And then you had a third one, right?
So, summary, you can do a cliffhanger, which I think is closure. Excuse me. You can do the cliffhanger, or you can do closure. And I like closure that is either with an open door to a
Okay.
new story, or closure where you're done.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And sometimes you're doing both. Like my novel, The Monsters We Defy, is a standalone, but I get asked every week if there's going to be a sequel because I did leave open windows. I closed the door, I shut it behind
Give me
me, but
that
there's a window, and there were still some questions there that I didn't know the answer to, quite frankly. But like the main story, the heist was done.
Exactly. You answer the main story questions and you left some dangling. I think that that is great story craft.
Yeah, I like stories like that myself too, because I do kind of want readers to walk away thinking, having the story live in their hearts a little bit
Exactly.
longer.
It invites fandom too, because they want to, if you're not going to do it, then I'm going to do it.
Yeah, fan fiction. Many a fan fiction has been born from endings that, readers and watchers did not like and wanted to fix and wanted to continue living with those characters.
Yes.
So, okay, we've talked a bit about, entries in a series versus serials. Serials and series have more tolerance for cliffhangers, but these things should still be resolved. Like something has to be resolved in the sections. So it begs the question, how do we tie up these loose ends? Do we need to tie up all of the loose ends? One thing that I do in my writing that I learned from Mary Robinette Kowal when she was on Writing Excuses, which I listened to for many years, it's a podcast. She talked, that's where I first heard her talk about, the idea of opening and closing doors in the same order, or closing doors in the same order that you open them. So they're nested like Russian dolls. So they think about your subplots or any of the minor story questions that you have. If you kind of plot them out and write them and say, okay, if we started with plot line A and then we go down to say we have D, then D needs to close and then C and then B and then A at the end. And that is a way to make it feel like orderly, you know, you close them in the order they were opened. So you're closing one nested box, one lid is on it. In the bigger box, the lid gets put on it. And it just feels, it feels good, you know, when you do that. So that's subplots, character arcs, the mysteries, the twists. It's just inherently satisfying. And I tend to do this, not 100%, but maybe like 90%.
I know we're both plotters and outliners. I wonder if how we could guide pantsers to follow the strategy.
I mean, I think that, you know, pantsers are intuitive writers, and that happens in revision. So maybe they'll figure things out. You know, they might not know until they get there. And then it's like, oh, well, what if I move this around? It'll be more satisfying than however it came out when you discovered it as you were writing it. So much of the way that discovery writers work, I think, happens in the revision. That's my belief.
Mine too, because they're looking for the structure. The first draft is their outline.
Yeah. And even, I mean, as a plotter, even though I have an outline, my first draft is really refining the outline. It's testing and proving it and changing it often because it shifts during the midpoint. And then the second draft is really the beauty of the writing when it's like, okay, now I can take these puzzle pieces that I've dumped out onto the table and organize them into the way they're supposed to be.
I am with you.
Also, a thing about endings, you know, each writer is, they have something to say about the world. Even, you know, a romance is the belief that love conquers all, or that, you know, we are better connected than we are apart. There's all kinds of themes, good versus evil, you know, just the life themes. So the ending includes that writer's message about life, and that turns out to be the theme. So even if you're not consciously aware that you are working with certain themes, because sometimes we are and sometimes we aren't, however the ending comes out is how you can figure out what your theme is. So does the hero win or lose? Are you writing a tragedy or a victory? It says something about your worldview and whether you are more positive or more cynical, and or what you might have been thinking and feeling at the time you were writing that, because that doesn't have to be your eternal worldview. Also, there's common wisdom that you might hear is that endings should be surprising yet inevitable. And it sounds really good, but it's always like, how do you do that?
How do you do that, Leslie?
You have to surprise yourself. And this is where I think that I have something in common with pantsers sometimes. Like, I know the ending, but I often and generally do not know how I'm going to get there exactly. You know, I know, okay, this sounds good. This is the logical conclusion of everything that I've been setting up. I will figure it out in the future. Future Leslie will have the problem of making this ending work and, you know, getting that puzzle together. So a lot of this is going to happen in second drafts and beyond. First of all, you know, it's even as an inveterate plotter, like it just doesn't come out the first time. Sometimes I have to live through the story. I have to live through the characters to really understand what the ending should be and why it works. And then after that, it's about going back and laying the groundwork early on so that you can create that satisfying ending. The stories are cyclical often. So, you know, the end is the beginning and the beginning is the end.
I love a cyclical ending. That's one of my favorites. I grew up on Saturday morning cartoons and after school specials where there were always morals to the story. I was telling somebody something. I was like, my family is Catholic. I am not. But I remember Sunday school, and I didn't like going to church. That was boring. It was a boring old lecture. But in Sunday school, they taught you stories. They read stories, and I loved that. I asked too many questions, so of course I didn't to go. But I love the idea of the morals. And another framework that really helped me was Blake Snyder in the second Save the Cat writes a novel book, Save the Cat book, which I think Save the Cat goes to the movies, maybe.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He talks about the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. So act one is a thesis. You're trying to prove something. Really, as the writer, you're trying to prove something. Like, love will conquer all. Mm-hmm. And then in the second act is all the antithesis. Like, no, love ain't gonna work out here. And then in the third act is synthesis. Like, love will help you to rise above if you work together or something like that. And when I think about my stories in this structure of, I'm going to prove something. Whoops, I'm going to fall down on my face. And ooh, let's all come together and compromise. Mm. That's usually where the surprises come for me.
Interesting. Yeah. And you were the one who told me about this synthesis antithesis, because I never got around to Save the Cat goes to the movies, or, you know, the first one was blew my mind enough that I was like, okay, let me focus on this. But it makes a lot of sense. And I don't do that consciously, but I think subconsciously, you know, intuitively, we've consumed so many stories that a lot of us are doing this, mm-hmm. you know, subconsciously, and we can't necessarily bring it to mind. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And then there's the idea of mirroring, you know, like mm-hmm. what's the opening image and the closing image, and can yes. they be the same thing? How can they be related? That gives you that sense of closure, that sense of surprising yet inevitable, because everything comes back home. The hero's journey, when you see it charted out, is a literal circle. You know, the hero starts at home and ends at home. And I think the heroine's journey, the same thing.
That's the same, but the difference is the hero, I don't think the hero goes back home. He comes back home, but then he has to leave again because that world doesn't fit him. Mm-hmm. The heroine can come back home.
Okay, and the heroine's journey, yeah. And if you're not familiar with those two, the heroine's journey, there's a book by Gal Carriger, which is a great overview of just a different way of telling the story with different values. And it probably supports slightly different themes than your traditional hero's journey.
So Jack Reacher, constant hero's journey. He just mm-hmm. keeps going and going. Same with James Bond, constant mm-hmm. hero's journey. Even Supernatural, well, no. You would think that's a hero's journey, but that's brotherly love. Harry Potter,
heroine's
journey.
Yeah, because he's gathering people. He's yep. bringing them together. It's not about being alone and being this iconoclast, you know, solo practitioner. It's about bringing community together in yep. order to solve your problems.
Yep. Most love stories are heroine's journeys.
Yeah.
Because the community, even if it doesn't go outside of the couple, it is the lovers that they've built their community amongst themselves, at least. Between themselves.
Yeah. And someone like Nalini Singh is always doing this. It's yeah. always about community. You can see her themes so clear, especially in this long series yes. where it's just hammered home. Like, everything is about bringing people together, communities, mm-hmm. pack, family. You know, it's like the Fast and the Furious. It's all about
heroine's journey.
Heroine's journey. Even though they're driving fast cars, it's a heroine's journey.
It's family. That's even their slogan. It's about family.
Exactly. So yeah, we want to have these loops, these round shape stories that are warm and fuzzy and come back to the beginning to end it in a way, like thematically. Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so there's other like practical tools that you can use when you're crafting the end, and you can see them in a lot of stories if you are paying attention and breaking them down. So in Save the Cat, and Save the Cat writes a novel at least, they break down the 5-part finale.
Save the Cat as well.
It's in the original? Okay. Mm-hmm. I use the Save the Cat writes a novel because it's so focused on book writing. The original is a good overview, but it is very much focused on screenwriting and kind of have to extrapolate. So the 5-part finale is basically, is it the entirety of the third act, would you say?
It is. It is. It starts with break into act 3. And then it's called the finale. But then I guess someone was saying, well, what is the finale? And then he broke it down even further into the 5 parts.
Right. And so those 5 parts are gathering the team, executing the plan, the Hightower surprise, dig deep down, and then executing the new plan. Mm-hmm. So it's another, you know, set of steps that you can use to make your final battle, your final finale more exciting, because you're going to have to storm the castle. That's kind of the whole beat. But you could get your team together. The plan can never work initially, like the way that you thought it was going to work, because that's just too predictable. So that's why you have the Hightower surprise. Mm-hmm. And then the hero or heroine or whomever has to dig deep down, get that thing inside of them, complete the journey. So usually by this time, the internal character arc will have been completed and they're using that knowledge and that growth to fuel the new plan that will succeed.
So I, because I'm not good at the 5-part finale, because I get to the dark moment and my hero and heroine are apart for too long. Pages is too long. And so I get them to the grand gesture and I get them kissing happily ever after. But I love Blake Snyder's framework. So I studied this and I think I've always thought that Marvel does this better than anybody else. So I broke down 5 Marvel movies looking specifically at their 5-part finales on my Substack. I'll put the link in the show notes, but I broke down The Incredible Hulk and tried to find the love story
in the Marvel.
So movie. I broke down The Incredible Hulk, Doctor Strange, Black Panther, which is another heroine's journey. It's Incredible Hulk and Doctor Strange, their heroes' journey. Mm. Thor starts hero's journey, and then he starts to gather people around as the saga progresses. Mm-hmm. And Guardians of the Galaxy is another heroine's journey because he gathers. But I broke down 5-part finale in each of those because I think nobody does it better than Marvel.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a reason. And so there's another kind of version of this, which is 6 parts. And then I found out through the old self-publishing guys, Johnny, Sean, and Dave. Sterling and Stone is their company now. And I downloaded this outline that they had online from years ago. And they have the 6 parts, which can be helpful too. It's very similar, but they're, you know, it's a little bit different. So the first one is preparing for battle. Then 2, take the fight to the enemy. 3, first contact. Then war of attrition. Then mano a mano. And then finally, from the ashes of disaster.
Ooh.
So it overlays kind of, but that idea of that mano a mano, which you often see with, you know, in hero's journey specifically, like, but in heroines too, when it's like these two people have to battle it out. And it's personal now, you know, that whole thing. So that's another way to think about it that I thought was really interesting. And sometimes, you know, if 5 don't work, hey, try 6.
Fair.
So they're sort of universally thought of as things to avoid when doing your ending. The biggest one of them is the deus ex machina.
What does that mean, Leslie?
It is Latin for God in the machine, and it is essentially has to do with coincidence. Coincidence is your enemy. So when some higher power comes in, breaking all the rules, negating all of the change and the growth that your hero has gone through and just fixes it for them with a snap of their fingers, that is your deus ex machina. And it can come in lots of different forms, but if there is an overpowered deity figure or a character or a situation that is sort of outside of the rest of the story that just comes in. And I can think of, I'm not going to mention it, there's a book that I think we both read where this happens, where, you know, there's a magical character whose father is this super powerful, almost deity figure who comes in and saves the day. And, you know, I love that series and that author, so you forgive it. But as I'm reading and I'm like, okay, this is totally deus ex machina and this should not work. And it robs you of the emotional resonance of it. It robs the characters of their growth because, you know, with your 5-part finale, when they're digging deep down, they have to find the strength within themselves, which is just very much a value of commercial Western fiction, as far as I know, to, you know, find that strength, the answer is within you, that whole thing. And so when you're taking that away because some other superpowered character fixes everything, it just makes the story less resonant, makes it less satisfying. Another thing to avoid in the ending is rushing it without giving it space to unfold naturally. Now, as a writer, by the time I get to the end, I am probably exhausted. And I have been guilty of rushing an ending or two in my time. I will totally cop to that because, yeah, like I just need this book to end sometimes. And I try to then go back in other drafts and flesh it out more. Because, even my first drafts are notoriously, the ending are extremely short. I'm just writing and then he wins, you know, like they fight and win because I just have lost all my energy. So it's a matter of kind of going back, spacing it out, giving the room to breathe and the characters that room to grow and to come to these conclusions and figure out the mystery if necessary in a logical way. You just don't want to sprint across the finish line yeah. when you've been having a good pace.
This is when I think these checklists really matter. Like you go back and you look at like, what did you do in the beginning? Can you bookend? Can you make a mirror? What are the subplots that you opened up? Have you answered them? Do you need another scene? Where are all of your sub characters? Are they all accounted for? Like, I think people need to start checking things off and then doing it in a, make sure you're doing it in an interesting way too. Of course. Don't right. just like, oh, such and such went away. Like do a summary. Such and such went away. Such and such got the girl.
Yeah. And also, where's the dog? A lot of times dogs get lost in books. Like they're there for the first half and then you don't have anything to do with the dog for the dog. Oh, so the dog just disappears.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Find your dog.
Oh my goodness.
But also, overly tidy resolutions can be just as bad as unresolved. Mm. They can be just as unsatisfying. You know, like that bow thing. Like we don't necessarily want the bow. Sometimes a summary works, but sometimes it's just too much. And maybe less so for romance, like a contemporary romance, than something with other external conflicts happening. I don't think that romance readers have as much of a problem with it. But if it's, you know, even a romantic suspense or a fantasy sci-fi romance, this is something about it being too tidy. Like you want a little bit of grit. You want maybe to walk away with a question or two, wondering, not plot holes, but
yeah,
something just to keep your interest in it. Another thing that is tough is an unearned twist. And I have been reading a lot more thrillers recently. And, you know, thriller genre knows we're expecting a twist. You need a twist. It's part of the genre convention at this point. And it can be really hard to make it earned, to make it feel like it's not coming out of left field, completely out of the blue. You want it surprising yet inevitable, so that when you look back, you're like, oh, the clues were there. I was just misdirected or I didn't pay attention to them.
Yeah. But I like the first thing that you said, the clues were there. But mm-hmm. I feel like that comes from you going back and doing at least one other draft.
Absolutely. I think so too. I mean, I think there may be certain people who can do it, you know, initially mm-hmm. and they have it all in their mind, but the rest of us have to kind of go back, layer it in, you know, plant the seeds, do our red herrings, try to, you know, put something in your hand over here while you're bringing the audience over here, sleight of hand tricks in your writing, and foreshadowing. It's really mm-hmm. about that foreshadowing. It's always wonderful to me when I have a twist and I see or hear from readers who are like, I didn't guess it. I didn't know it was coming. And I'm like, mm-hmm. yes. Because to me, it always feels like, oh, it's so obvious. And I want it to be not obvious, but there when you go back and look at
yeah.
it. And yeah, it's something you can't, because some readers are just more savvy than others. And so it's just not going to work for everybody. But like, you're really trying to. And then the best thrillers are doing that really well. And mm-hmm. some of them are not, unfortunately. Also, you don't want to ignore genre or reader expectations. Mysteries have to be solved. Romances have to have an HEA, or happily ever after. It's non-negotiable. I'm sorry.
It really is non-negotiable.
And it's one of those things that someone tells you it's a romance, because people who don't know, and I'm going to blame ignorance and not malicious intent. Some people don't know, and they believe that if people fall in love and there's kissing scenes, then it's a romance. But if those people die at the end or don't end up together, it is not in the modern definition of the word. So.
And don't, like, listen to what we're saying. Like, don't discount what the genre expectations are, what the readers want, because that's your customer. Unless your customer is just your muse and you can do whatever you want for you and your muse. But when you put that book on the market and the reader gets a whiff of it and they're like, you killed the hero?
Yeah.
This is not a romance. Or if all of a sudden, you know, a zipper goes down and a penis comes out. That's not a clean, wholesome room. So you have to listen. Like if someone is, I love what Melanie Harlow says. Like if someone orders spaghetti, don't give them cake. They didn't ask you for the cake.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you're going to get mad when readers come at you saying, I did not order this cake. I'm on a freaking diet. Give me the spaghetti. So it's so important. And just be honest, like if you're going to kill the hero at the end, that's totally cool. Don't put it on the romance shelf.
Yeah. And depending on what other shelf it's on, you know, it might not fit on certain other shelves as well. But like, I understand that people want to be different and they want to be artists, and it's a place for that. It's called literary fiction. you know, the rest of us, we want to know what we're getting ourselves into most of the time.
Yeah, agreed.
And then the final thing I have as my list to avoid is, it was all a dream. We don't do that anymore. Someone 200 years ago probably did that just fine. It was great. Ever since then, no, we can't.
Well, wait, there was one time in the history of humanity that it worked. And I can't remember the name of the guy. So there was a television show. Oh my gosh. Do you watch Big Bang Theory?
Not really.
Oh gosh. I can't remember this guy's name. Was it like Newhart or something?
Oh, Bob Newhart.
Right. And he did one show and then he did another show and they woke up and he wakes up and he's like, it was all a dream. And he was still his old character of Newhart.
Oh,
wow. It shows you how old I am.
That's an Easter egg that I think, yes, maybe the only time in the history.
The only time in the history of humanity.
Where it could have worked. If you're doing something very meta, you know, that could be interesting.
Yes.
So, okay, how do you leave your readers? The last lines, either the very last line or the very last few lines. You know, a lot of times writers pore over the opening lines. And with good reason, like, you know, you're not going to hook the reader if the opening lines, we did a whole thing on opening lines. But last lines should not be forgotten about because it's the last thing they remember. The readers remember that last emotion, and they may not remember the exact last lines, but the last line incorporates those emotions, which are going to be like the shortcut or the code for what they felt for the book. So we talked about mirroring and echoing. Can you do something to mirror or echo the opening lines? Is there something there that calls back, or like an inside joke even?
You introduced me to Margie Lawson, her courses, mm-hmm. and you introduced me to her, the person as well. But I remember she had a course where she talks about the power words and putting them at the end of sentences and the end of scenes.
Yeah.
That's a really good resource.
Yeah, she has these lecture packets and highly recommended for all who want to study writing. And yeah, if we can find those and put those in the notes, because she does talk about power words and you know, evoking character emotion. And so that is,
I think that was the name of the class.
Yeah, I think so too. And they're inexpensive lecture packets that are super, super helpful. So yeah, think about the emotion in the last line and the tone that you're going to leave your readers with. And then also in your last line, you can reinforce the theme. You can drive home, you know, this notion of the world that you think is important, that you've poured into the pages of this book. That, you know, that last line that shows that this couple is really going to be together forever, or that really understand each other on a deep level, so that they're joking with each other, something that couldn't have happened at the beginning of the book. There are lots of different ways to do it, lots of different writerly techniques to just drive it home, put that stake in their heart, and just keep it there so that they will walk away remembering, oh gosh, I really loved that book. And maybe even start over at the beginning again, like some of us do.
Yes.
So there's a couple of examples of unsatisfying endings, mostly TV and film, because I'm not going to necessarily list out books. But, you know, I was always haunted because I was writing the end of my epic fantasy series at the time when Game of Thrones ended. And the ending of Game of Thrones is controversially but notoriously poor and unsatisfying for many reasons. And so when you have a long series like that, and we'll probably never know how the books end because the books might be over right now.
Oh my gosh. That poor man.
Well, not poor at all.
He's not poor, but.
And he's not writing these books.
he can't be on social media because, oh my goodness.
Yeah. But yes, the TV series, I mean, and they give these people another series. They've given them many, many opportunities. They did the new Three Body Problem, I believe, the series, the guys who did Game of Thrones TV show. Even though they proved that they could not end Game of Thrones. Well, we mentioned Lost. I didn't watch Lost, but it's another notoriously bad ending. You know, J.J. Abrams is famous for his mystery box theory, and it just shows you how the mystery boxes can be taken too far so that you have no idea. You've opened too many mysteries. That's another thing. Don't open too many mysteries. Open them as many as you can solve.
Yeah, be the onion.
Yes.
Open them and then close them in the order, like Mary Robinette said.
Exactly. And yeah. Now, The Sopranos is one of those ambiguous endings that was also controversial. Mm-hmm. So ambiguous endings can be great, but I think they're often going to be controversial because so many people just want their closure. They want that ending.
I think this is a matter of audience with The Sopranos, because I think you can do this if you're like an art house film, a student film, but that wasn't this audience. This was a very commercial audience, and you had set their expectations differently when you ended that show.
That is a very good point. Yeah, it's remembering the genre that you're in, remembering what your expectations of your audience are. Because, exactly, yeah, like if you need to look up the ending in The Sopranos after 20 years or whatever it's been, it was just, you know, that kind of fade to black. We don't know what's going to happen. Neither do you. Yeah, not great. Yeah. And then I watched the first season of Dexter, but I didn't follow along with it. But that was another show when it ended, people were kind of big mad about how it ended with unsatisfying,
because I didn't finish any of these shows either.
The only one I finished was Game of Thrones, so.
And I was there for the live tweeting, well, live texting of Game of Thrones.
the metaphorically throwing the book across the room, throwing the remote across the room, or being mad. Lots of conversation, lots of talking each other off ledges.
Out of the darkness.
Yeah.
Because it was so dark.
And it just proves, you know, endings are important. So take care, tread carefully, and hopefully some of these tips will help you do what you're ending in a way that serves your audience and doesn't make them mad at you.
Well, speaking of endings, Leslie, have you gotten to the end of anything that you've been watching or reading that you have found satisfying?
Actually, yes. I finally read Kimberly Lemming's That Time I Got Drunk and Saved a Demon. And it was just as delightful as it sounds. Hopefully it sounds delightful, because it is. It's hilarious, it's hot, it's funny, it's great. Cozy fantasy romance, although I know that she kind of balked at being called cozy, but we will ask her when we talk to her, because she will be on the podcast soon. But yes, delightful series. It's, you know, been on my radar, actually been on my Kindle for a while. It's one of those things where I had to be in the mood, and I was in the mood for some humor, and it did not disappoint. It's very irreverent. It's one of those things that made me think of like a bunch of other things where that they're using modern language and modern concepts in this, you know, historical fantasy time period with all these different creatures. But yes, it's a lot of fun. I also watched something that I wanted to mention too on Netflix. It's a movie called The Tearsmith. Have you seen this?
No.
It's Italian. It's this Italian sort of YA romance. I guess it was like a Wattpad book or maybe something like that. And it was completely bonkers, very much bananas, made absolutely no sense, but I was not mad at it. It was one of those things that does not hold together with like even a moment's scrutiny. It's 100% vibes. There was a plot, but like I said, don't like look at it too closely or pick it apart. The dialogue was kind of cringy, but there was so much intensity. And you know, it's these two kids who were in an orphanage and they were adopted together. And of course he's secretly in love with her, but he's this brooding bad boy, and, you know, hijinks ensue. It was absolutely bananas, but I still appreciated it. And I would probably watch it again, even though it was very bad. So I just thought I would mention that. Like, recommended, but know what you're getting yourself into. If you want all the vibes of like any angsty YA, it's not really fantasy, but it's got fairy tale vibes to it. I recommend it with the caveat that it makes no sense, and don't think about it too hard. Okay. What about you? Have you been watching or reading or?
Well, I've been reading, but the thing is, I've become an audiobook listener. You know, ever since my eyes are starting to get old and they get tired, and I need the glasses. But I've had a Kindle Unlimited subscription for I don't know how long, and I don't use it because I don't really read with my eyes a whole bunch.
Right.
But it's still cost effective because I still read a lot. But I got a Kindle Scribe. Actually won it. I won a Kindle Scribe, and it's just been sitting there. And I went away this week on a writing thing, and I downloaded some books some short reads to the Kindle Scribe. And I was like, I'm going to read these and I'm going to use the annotation feature. And I did that. I read them. I used the annotation feature and I absolutely positively loved it because I like taking notes, but I like taking notes either in a bullet journal or sometimes I resort to having taking notes at the notes app on my phone. But I took notes right in the Kindle Scribe. I didn't really understand what people were doing with this thing. I was highlighting, I was writing on it and taking notes, and then I could just email it to myself.
Yeah.
I didn't realize this was a thing. And so now I have all these PDFs of notes where I'm like, can easily and quickly break books down. Revelation. So I've read a lot of books on the Kindle Scribe. But this is my thing right now is annotating on the Kindle Scribe.
I too have a Kindle Scribe, and I was a little disappointed that I couldn't write in the book, like on top of the words.
Yeah.
You have to highlight, and then you're kind of making a note. Yep. Then you can write with the stylus,
yep.
Which is fine. It's just not the thing that I thought I was going to be able to do with it. So I don't use mine that much, but I'm so happy that you are like loving it and just breaking down more books. Yes. The world need for you to break down more books? I'm a little scared about the product of all of this breakdown.
We'll see. I have ideas.
Always. You are so full of ideas, but it's good. It's good to see it. Yes. And then many people benefit from these ideas too.
I think you will. And I hope you guys benefited from this episode. Thank you so much for joining us. And let us know what you think. You can leave a comment on YouTube with your thoughts on this episode. You can share it with a friend who loves romance and maybe loves the Kindle Scribe. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And you can always check out our book schedule on our website, inkandmagic.net, to read along with us. We are in our Arrow era of side changeling and loving it. So please read along and join us. And then we will see you the next time. Bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.